What are the misperceptions people have about stress?
It's not about living a life with zero stress. That is biologically impossible. We as human beings need stress to move our life forward. It is not the enemy we think it is.
I'm thrilled to introduce Aditi Narukar.
Is a Harvard physician, nationally recognized stress expert, renowned Fortune 50 speaker and podcaster.
Mother, storyteller, and Harvard-trained integrative medicine physician.
With an expertise in stress and resilience, I've also worked in refugee health with the WHO.
And she's a physician and lecturer on global health and social medicine.
We're fighting things like, you know, metaphorical tigers, bills, health conditions, relationship issues, financial constraints, parenting challenges.
Then how can you build up the resilience muscles to handle more stress in the future?
So the first kind of part of that is...
Aditi, thanks so much for coming on the show. Excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I love your show.
Well, you got a book coming out. It's called Five Resets, Rewire Your Brain and Body for Less Stress and More Resilience. The thing that really struck out at me when you were talking is the misperception people have around stress. What are those misperceptions from the conversations you've had? You have over 20 years of clinical experience helping clients with this. What are the misperceptions people have about stress? And in your opinion, why is stress good in some sense?
The thing about stress is that it is not the enemy we think it is. In fact, there are two different kinds of stress. There is healthy stress and unhealthy stress. Healthy stress in scientific terms is called adaptive stress. So everything good in your life, Sean, is because of a little bit of healthy stress, like you are currently traveling, booking those flights, getting the hotel room, planning your itinerary, things that we don't necessarily think of as unhealthy, bad stress. These are all positive things, things that got us together today, syncing up our schedules. All of the good things in our life that have taken a little bit of effort are because of healthy stress. Unhealthy stress is what we think of in pop culture when we think about that, you know, four-letter word stress. Unhealthy stress, in scientific terms, is called maladaptive stress. And that is what we're really trying to tackle here. And what I really focus on, my work focuses on, it's not about living a life with zero stress. That is biologically impossible. We as human beings need stress to move our life forward. However, it is all about the dosing of stress, meaning keeping it manageable and healthy and adaptive. And of course, you know, the amount and frequency. So the goal together in our conversation, in my work with patients, is to live a life of healthy, manageable stress.
Yeah, absolutely. And with stress, I mean, as you mentioned, when I think about stress, it is one or two. I mean, a lot of people, they're in the health world, you know, people think about biohacking and getting, you know, cold exposure, you're going into an ice bath and you're in immense amount of stress for a temporary amount of time. You might be fasting and your body is stressing, but it's trying to, you know, fight through the hunger, and actually it makes you stronger and healthier. So that in that short temporary amount of stress, it is a very good thing in this sense. So talk to me a little bit more about the bad stress. Are these kind of the chronic stresses that you would face for day-to-day activities that people have?
So, Sean, what you're describing, the biohacking and cold plunge, et cetera, are cellular stresses, stresses on the body that have a certain effect on the mitochondria and the DNA. What the stress that I talk about is psychological stress. So things that happen to our brains and our minds and our perception of stress. So those are two different things. What is happening to our body and our mind? Of course, it's all connected because of the mind-body connection. But when we think about what you're describing as quote unquote bad stress, you know, things that make us feel anxious or depressed or lose sleep, there's so many manifestations of negative stress: headaches, dizziness, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, chronic body pains. stress manifests itself in various different ways. That's not to say that medical conditions are caused by stress, but they are certainly worsened by stress. And what happens to our brains during chronic stress? So we are very good, like you said, at adapting to short-term stress. Our brains and our bodies are designed for this. It's the fight or flight response. There is a part of our brain called the amygdala that governs our stress response. And evolutionarily speaking, when we saw a tiger in the forest, it is that acute stress response that really takes shape. So it's called fight or flight, or the stress response. And so you know, our ancestors in the forest would see the tiger and then would be able to either fight or flee. And there's a whole way, a whole cascade of biological processes that happen in the body during that immediate acute threat. Your heart starts pumping faster. Your lungs start breathing quicker. Blood, fresh oxygenated blood, is shunted away from your vital organs to your muscles so you can run, so you can flee or fight. Once that acute stressor is over and the fight or flight response is over, our body equilibrates and goes back to equilibrium. And that is a very important part of the stress response, because yes, we have a wonderful, strong, and robust stress response in acute settings, but we need to come back to baseline. The real challenge with chronic stress is that we don't come back to baseline. Now, when we think about tigers in the forest, we're not fighting real tigers in the forest now. We're fighting things like, you know, metaphorical tigers, bills, health conditions, relationship issues, financial constraints, parenting challenges. These are not acute things. They are low grade or chronic, sometimes high grade, but they flare, ebb and flow, and they don't ever go away. And so our stress response remains active in the background. That amygdala, the bean-shaped structure in our brain that's responsible for stress that turns on or off, is chronically on. And so what happens with chronic stress over time, if it is not managed away from unhealthy back to healthy stress, is that it can lead to burnout. And we know this because all around the world, in every sector, in every country, we are now seeing unprecedented rates of burnout. And a lot of that is because of chronic, unmitigated stress that has just continued on and on and on. The important thing to know about chronic stress is that if you are feeling this, and if you're listening and saying, of course I feel chronic stress, I do too, I'm sure you do too, Sean. Stress is not your fault if it is happening to you. And we can talk a little bit about why so many of us are stressed. And you're not alone, because again, burnout and stress are not the exception. They are the rule, especially now.
And physiologically speaking, when you're talking about chronic versus acute, is it the same things that are happening physiologically in our bodies? The only difference is the intensity and the length of how it happens?
So when you are facing acute and chronic stress, yes, you are having the same physiological processes. There is something in the brain called the HPA axis. It's the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. We can get into it if you want. But that axis, which connects the brain to the body, is essentially the highway of stress information and signaling. So something happens externally in your life, or, you know, something happens with someone else, a relationship or work, and you are triggered, your stress response is triggered, and that HPA axis is triggered. In an acute setting, the same thing happens. That is triggered, and your amygdala, which is another part of your brain that's connected to the HPA axis very closely, starts firing away and gets activated. And in chronic stress, the same thing happens, but it just continues on. So it's less about the intensity and more about the duration. So in an acute stress setting, you could have a short burst of intense stress, right? Like a tiger in the forest, or there's many modern day examples of acute stress. You know, something happens to your house and suddenly you're feeling, you know, a sense of acute stress. And then that external issue is remediated and reconciled, and then you are back to your baseline. The problem is that that biological mechanism in your brain and your body during chronic stress is activated for a longer period of time, and in many cases just stays activated. It's not so much about the intensity. It's more so about the duration and the lack of respite. We don't have rest and recovery. Our brains and our bodies are wonderfully designed to handle stress in short terms. But when it becomes long term without rest and recovery, that's when problems set in.
Yeah, there's a term for it, right? I think it's called hormesis. H-O-R-M-E-S-I-S, yeah.
Yes, and that's what when you're describing things like cold plunge and other things like that, that's the sort of bucket of interventions. The work that I do focuses mostly on psychological stress rather than bodily stress. Of course, they're somewhat connected, but you know, when I describe the experience of stress, I think many of us can relate to stress. Like, what does it feel like for you when you're stressed? We all have our own versions of it and our own flavors of that. But that experience, that perception of stress is really what I'm talking about when I talk about stress, less so about the cellular and molecular mechanisms.
Right, right. And I can see why they're connected, because of the fact that if you do have the physiological aspect of it, you are still getting the psychological, stress, acute stress effects of it. But when you're talking about the modern day, you know, the modern person that's listening to this, it seems that there is more than ever chronic stress that are happening because of the media, the bad news that are coming out, the social media notifications. We're constantly on our phones, and it's generally wired to provide some sort of emergency news or alert news that aren't always to our favor. And is that kind of where you're taking the direction of your message for the book? Is that before, when you're talking about, you know, our ancestors, they would see a tiger and they would have to hunt, and there'd be this intense amount of acute stress, and it was kind of life or death where they had to be reactive. And today we're kind of having the opposite effect, where we're getting that chronic stress all the time, but we're not getting the as much acute stress in our daily lives that are more designed to benefit us. Or are you just saying, it's more about removing the chronic stress?
I think it's both. We have to, only when we can manage, it's difficult to remove chronic stress at this point, right? Like, we have things that are just going on in our lives with all of the things that I mentioned, and it's difficult. It's, you know, virtually impossible to remove chronic stress, but we can lower the volume of chronic stress in our lives by doing a couple of things that I talk about in the five resets. And when we are able to have a greater sense of bandwidth in our brains and our bodies, we can handle acute stress better as well. So it's all very connected. And so the five resets are essentially five small mindset shifts that really help people feel a sense of grounding and control in times of difficulty. So I think many of us right now are feeling that sense of difficulty in our day-to-day lives. It has become, very much, it's become the norm. And there are ways that are science-backed, practical, effective, and most of all free, because many of the patients that I see a variety of patients from all walks of life. And when I was in a clinical practice, when I was seeing patients, I saw patients from all walks of life. And, you know, everything that I offer in this book is based on those clinical interactions, because I always want to make sure that everything I offer is free. That is a very low time investment, because all of us are very busy. We lead overscheduled lives. And so many of us, I think one of the key things that I do in the five resets in my life, when I was seeing patients, in my speaking, my work is really to close that gap between knowledge and information and action. Many of us may know what is good for us. So, for example, exercising, very important as a way to mitigate stress, or sleeping longer or deeper or better, also really important. A sense of connection with our loved ones and our tribe, Like you mentioned, minimizing social media use and staying off our phones. All of these things are important for minimizing our stress. But why is it that so few of us do it on a regular basis? It's because we have that sense of knowledge, but we are unable to act on it because there is just a wide gap. Again, it's not your fault. You are not alone. And so using the psychology of habit formation, using the tools of motivational interviewing and the decades of experience that I've had, I have been able to close that gap with many patients. And, you know, bringing someone from that idea of knowledge and information to action, bringing these principles into your daily life, it takes a little bit of time and a little bit of work, but it doesn't take as much time and work as you think it does. And then the return on investment, when you start really focusing on your stress and making strides, it is worth everything.
Yeah. I mean, I always thought about the idea of like handling stress as a muscle where you can build that up over time. If I think about 5 years ago or even 10 years ago, the situations or crises that would happen today, I would be head over heels, like freaking out. My heart would be thumping. Whereas today, because you see those things over time and you've built up the resilience for it, it doesn't really affect you as much anymore, which shows me that I have improved the way I can handle stress over time. But it seems like you can't really build up those muscles until you kind of push the limits of handling more stress. What are your opinions about that? I mean, because some people would say, okay, well, that can actually lead to burnout because you're constantly pushing yourself to handle more stress and to take on more stress. But at the same time, if you don't take those actions, then how can you build up the resilience muscles to handle more stress in the future?
I love that question. And there's a lot to unpack there. So the first kind of part of that is what we are facing in terms of the constant onslaught and barrage of crises in the world, in our lives. You know, yes, a huge part of what I talk about is how to decrease our reliance on external stresses like the headlines and social media and the news and all of these things which are built on the biology of stress, doom scrolling, other things like that. And we can talk about that a little later in our conversation. In terms of building it up for this sense of resilience, like first, I love where you're going with this because I talk a lot about the resilience myth and this idea of toxic resilience. So we have heard the word resilience over and over, over the past, say, like 3 to 4 years. Of course, it's been in the lexicon long before that, but certainly during the start of 2020, when many of us were in lockdown, I know many of us don't want to talk about that time of life, but it was a time that we heard the word resilience very often. It was used appropriately because the true definition of resilience is, the scientific definition, is our ability to adapt, recover, and grow and bounce back in the face of challenge. Now, true resilience needs stress, like you say, needs a little bit of stress to show itself. Without stress, there can be no resilience, and that's a very important thing. However, in 2021, 2022, and certainly 2023, the word resilience and what it means, that true resilience, shifted and morphed into something called toxic resilience. And this toxic resilience, it's this idea of mind over matter. No matter, you know, you can take on another project at work. You're resilient. Sure, you can handle extra things at home because you're resilient. So you keep hearing these messages, these toxic messages of resilience. And that's not true resilience, because true resilience honors your human limitations, honors your boundaries, celebrates the ability of you saying no, and really understands that it's about rest and recovery. And only through rest and recovery can that resilience build and grow. And so, yes, we have faced many onslaughts over the past several years that have tested us and have certainly fanned the flames of our resilience. But in addition, because of that frequency and constant nature, you know, the cyclical nature of these collective traumas in many instances, we are now getting into the territory of toxic resilience. And that is connected to the resilience myth, what I call the great resilience myth, which is that resilient people don't get burned out. You may have heard that. You may have said it to yourself. You may have heard a friend or a colleague say that to you, saying, oh, oh, of course I'm not burned out. I'm resilient. Or you can't get burned out. You're resilient. Or don't worry, nothing's going to happen to you. You're resilient. Again, lots of toxic resilience messages there. Because the truth is, based on the science, that resilient people can and do get burned out, especially now, even amongst the most resilient in the workforce. So 30% of the most resilient workers still were able to have burnout. And that's because research has shown that resilience, while it's somewhat important, and it's, you know, it's an important mechanism to somewhat protective for burnout, it doesn't prevent burnout. And so while in currently that word resilience, when I hear it, when you hear it, when other people hear it, you may bristle at it. And it's, you know, almost like cringe because you've heard it so many times. It's been misused, mm-hmm. especially over the past several years. So a lot of the work that I do with my patients, with my audiences, when I'm speaking, it's really shifting that narrative away from toxic resilience, back to true resilience. What does it mean? How can we claim that for ourselves? Resilience is our birthright. It is an innate biological ability that we all have. And I think it's somewhat dangerous when we use that word very frequently in pop culture, you know, in our world right now. And then people feel like, oh, I must not be resilient because I feel stressed or I feel burned out. Oh, it's probably, you know, and I'm here to say that notion of you are feeling burned out and you must not be resilient, I'm here to debunk that. I think that we all have an innate sense of resilience within us. And by simply the work of doing a little bit, we can reset our stress to really show that resilience and bring it forward.
Yeah, it's a unique term. I haven't heard the term toxic resilience before, but in some ways I agree with you. There's this hustle culture of constantly doing more, staying up, getting 4 hours of sleep. And I don't think that is actually the route to go if you want to win and be more successful in the long run. It's kind of like the resilience of doing a sprint versus a marathon. Eventually, if you just keep trying to push the limits, you're just going to burn out in the long marathon, even though you might win the sprint. But in most things that we want to do, it is a marathon. Most companies you want to build take a long time. Most projects you want, podcast growth, all these things, it's a long-term game. Where do people find that middle line, right? Because you could also argue in the other side of saying that some people give up too easily. Some people do go to the gym, they do a couple of reps, and they say, okay, this is too hard. Or they work a couple of hours and they think, okay, I feel a little stressed out, I think I'm going to pause, versus someone that might push it to the limit. So how do we find that middle balance for people that aren't really sure where they are in that spectrum? And maybe that first step is to help people be more self-aware of where they are in that stress burnout spectrum.
That's a beautiful question. And it is so important in the work that I've done, of course, on myself and with patients and with my audiences. And essentially, when, for example, the first reset, it's, you know, what matters to you most, right? So most, MOST, it's a most goal. It's an acronym that I describe in the book. And when you figure out your why and what your reason is for feeling less stressed, you're more likely to close that gap between knowledge and action. And so how do you get there? And that's the work that I do with my patients. And that's the work that I've written about in the book, because it's a way for you to get a glimpse into my clinical decision-making and how I practice. The key with finding that middle ground is understanding what your end game is. And so it's less about what's the matter with me and rather what matters to me most. And when you can craft that long-term goal or plan, and it doesn't have to be long-term, say 5 years from now, it can just be, you know, in the next 6 months, I would like to, or that in the next 3 months, I would like to. I give many examples and patient stories throughout the book about how people have found their most goal. And when you can craft and see that vision 3 to 6 months from now, then you can build a roadmap. And I walk you through step by step on how to build that roadmap for you, personalized roadmap to get there to that goal of whatever is meaningful to you. and then slowly take it step by step. So it's not about a big giant goal in front of you. It's about small steps. The smaller the steps, the better. So for you, you know, in your example of what you said, exercise, going to the gym, that is a common thing that happens. People have a sense of, I want to go to the gym and I want to get fit. So I'm going to go to the gym, right? January 1st, it's happening. I sign up for the gym and I'm going. Now, I talk about this often. It's the all or nothing fallacy. I write about it in the Five Resets. It's this idea that we are giving ourselves very little grace and very little self-compassion to mess up when we are saying we're going to start a fitness regimen. We say we're going to go to the gym 5 days a week for an hour a day. But if you have never done if you're not a regular exerciser and if you have never done a gym workout for an hour, you have an overscheduled life. You may have children. You may have 2-3 jobs. You may be building a company on the side. You may have health challenges. There are so many reasons why you can't get to the gym. And so you'll say, okay, I won't go today. I'll go tomorrow. Oh, something came up, an emergency. I won't go tomorrow. I'll go the next day. And you may have meant to go 5 days a week. And now instead you've gone 1 or 0 days a week. And then it does a number on you and you feel like, oh, I guess I can't fit this into my life. And so I'll give up. Instead, change the narrative, flip the script. It's not about an hour-long gym workout. It's about training your brain for exercise. How do we do that? We start with a 5-minute walk, build up to a 20-minute walk every day. This is not about necessarily physical fitness. It's about training your brain to exercise. When we are learning a new habit, it's more important to do something every day rather than once in a while, simply because it avoids decision fatigue. And decision fatigue is a lot of what happens when we are signing up for a new gym membership and saying that we're going to go every day. And so if you can build a 10 to 20 minute walk, which, by the way, is the same as a LinkedIn scroll or an Instagram or TikTok or Facebook scroll, 20 minutes. Swap out one of those scrolls, go for a 20-minute walk instead, do it every single day. And that, of course, has demonstrated effects on mood and stress and all of that, which we can talk about, but it creates a sense of habit. And habit formation takes 8 weeks to happen. Once you feel like, okay, I got this, maybe now I can incorporate an hour in the gym once a week, or maybe I can do twice a week. But it has to be slow and small, smaller than you think, if you really want to close that gap between knowledge and action. And there's, you know, I lay it out because all of these pitfalls that you're describing are all too common. And it's one of the reasons why people feel like, oh, I'm not going to manage my stress because it's too much work. Or, you know, I can't go to the gym every day. I can't eat salads every day. I can't do all of these things that seem out of reach and aspirational. But my work is making these things attainable, practical, and actionable in the here and now. So it's not about an hour-long workout in the gym 5 days a week. It's about a 5 to 10 to 20 minute walk every day. In time, in 3 months, you may say, I'm going to go take a walk. You know, you may say, oh, I'm going to go to the gym. And that is all because of personal agency, your sense of self-efficacy and your sense of agency, which is your ability to believe in yourself, that you have the tools to make it possible. All of that grows, but it takes a few practical, simple interventions like a daily walk to get there. And that's just one example, but we can go through other examples, but that's just kind of like the way you get yourself there. So if you think about, so I'm a parent, and I think many of your listeners may be parents too. When you think about watching your kids and how they learn to walk, they, you know, were crawling and they would stand up and then they would fall. And then they would stand up and then they would fall. And then it didn't happen like they're crawling and then one day they get up and they, you know, run down the hallway. It happens in slow, steady, measured steps with lots of setbacks. And that is actually the path forward. It is all about progress, not perfection.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. And I think that's a powerful point. I mean, there's a book by BJ Fogg. It's called The Power of Tiny Habits.
Yes. BJ is a friend of mine.
Oh, no way. That was a really inspiring book for me. Yes. And it really helped me shift that mindset of building a habit, because he talks about one particular example that really stuck with me is when people are trying to floss their teeth. Like you could not force me to floss my teeth. Like thinking back to my, you know, 20-year-old self, I'm like, there's no way you could have gotten me to do that. And I think it's been like 2-3 years now where I've been consistently doing it every day. And where it started was from this book that BJ Fogg wrote. And he says that if you want to get someone to floss, start with one tooth. Literally right. Just one tooth.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's the thought of doing that. Like if you can get someone just to floss one tooth, the thought of someone being there at that moment, stopping after one tooth is very rare, right? It's kind of like the hardest part about working out is getting to the gym. And I totally agree that in oftentimes when you're trying to climb a mountain, it's easier looking back than forward. And it is very intimidating for a lot of people to think about, oh, how am I going to get those 6-pack abs when I'm currently in this shape? But it's kind of making that daily progress and making it less intimidating, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And it's not even about, you know, as much as we would all love a 6-pack, wouldn't we all? Unfortunately, these aspirational and physical aspects of exercise is what keeps people from exercising. It's often the barrier because you look at these, you know, taut bodies and lots of muscles and you say, oh, I can never look like that. And so you don't do it. In fact, what gets people to exercise in my experience, my, you know, 20 plus years of clinical experience, is less about the cosmetic promise and more about the mental health promise. The mental health benefits of exercise, including a 20-minute walk, which is what I often prescribe to patients who are lifelong non-exercisers, that promise of what it can do to our mental and physical health, you know, to your level of stress, you don't need to have a 6-pack to use exercise to your advantage to have less stress. A 20-minute walk every day has had demonstrated effects on mood, sleep, energy, anxious thoughts, depressive thoughts. There are so many benefits. So it's less about the physical aspects of exercise and more about what daily movement, bringing in some daily movement into your life, whatever that may mean to you, what that can do for your brain and body for less stress. Taking it to the extreme, I would say, you know, even though I am a daily exerciser, but for a long time I was a lifelong non-exerciser. And I made that switch not by saying to myself, oh, I really want to get a 6-pack. So here I go. I'm going to get into this fitness routine. It was simply because I needed to manage my own stress when I was a medical resident working 80 hours a week and going through a very dark time with my own stress struggle, which I write about in the 5 Resets. I was a stressed patient and I needed to figure this out for myself so I could show up for my work, do my job, and have some engagement in life in a positive way, I started walking every day. And it was, and I went down to the gym, and I had a gym in my building, beautiful gym in my building at the time. Went down to the gym, looked at all the shiny equipment and the mirrors and the music blasting, and I walked right out. It was absolutely not for me. It felt very aspirational. It felt disconnected from where I was in my life at the time. When you are feeling that sense of deep stress, burnout, chronic stress, going to the gym and being in that environment is often the last thing you want to do. So you don't do it at all. Instead, shifting that and thinking about just moving your body. Our bodies are meant to move every day. It doesn't mean you have to run even a mile. It doesn't mean you have to run at all. It just means that you have to build in a little bit of movement. And then once you start building in a little bit of movement every day, you start feeling like, oh, my body enjoys this. Your stress starts decreasing because it's a physiological thing that happens when you start moving your body. It does impact your brain because of the mind-body connection, which is a lot of what I talk about. It's the basis of my research. And that is when change happens. It doesn't happen in these like gleaming, shiny billboard kind of ways. It happens slowly, incrementally, often, you know, in the midst of our messy lives. And then when we start walking, we say, oh, that felt really good. 5 minutes, I can do that. Let me try to go to 10 minutes tomorrow. Oh, I'm feeling okay with 10 minutes. Let me try to go to 20 minutes. And then before you know it, you're walking 30 minutes every single day. But it didn't happen overnight. It's certainly, you're not doing it for fitness in terms of like getting a 6-pack. You're doing it because of your mental health. And that hook of, wow, this helps me feel good, that is what keeps people going. not the physical promise of taut abs and big biceps. In fact, that's just a byproduct of being a regular exerciser.
Yeah, yeah. People kind of in the business world often talk, or maybe in the content world, it's not about trying to get to a million subscribers or selling a million books. You do the work on a daily basis, no matter how boring it is, you show up. And the byproduct is that oftentimes, if you last long enough and you do a good enough job, you get the result. What about bad habits? If someone is trying to cut out junk food, sugar, someone's trying to quit smoking, cut drinking out of their lives, is that what's that approach there when you're trying to take something out?
Great question. Typically, we use many things as coping mechanisms for our stress. Many of my patients in the past have self-medicated because they are trying to handle their stress the best they can. And so, you know, people start self-medicating through alcohol. Addiction is a whole nother category, which I don't think we can talk about because it's a little bit more nuanced and deeper. But let's talk about this idea of coping strategies and mm-hmm. why we do it when we have a lot of stress. So for example, emotional eating, like you brought up, it's called emotional eating. When I feel stressed, my food that I turn to is tortilla chips and salsa. I Ooh. Love the salty, crunchy, you must salsa. Have a food. Yeah. Tortilla yeah. chips and salsa. What's your stress trigger food?
Oh, it's gotta be something cheesy, something maybe like noodles. Anything with carbs is probably my right. kryptonite when it comes to this. I'm lucky I'm not stressed out right now talking about this because, as you know, that I'm in Asia, carbs are just a walk away. But yeah.
Yeah. So typically, you know, I also love like chocolate chips or something delicious as a dessert. And many of us, because this is how our brains are designed, when you are under stress, many of us crave high fat, high sugar foods because calories quite literally equal survival when it comes to stress. Your brain doesn't know the difference when you are feeling stressed and that amygdala is firing. Your brain doesn't know the difference that, oh, there's a big deadline looming in a week that you have to get done, or there's a famine coming, right? Stress is stress for your brain. And especially that part of your brain, the amygdala, which is what we call in scientific terms, your reptilian brain. So it's the part of our brain that hasn't necessarily evolved the same way as our prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is right here. If you put your hand on your forehead, it's the area of the brain right behind your forehead. That area, the prefrontal cortex, is responsible for memory, planning, organization, all of the things that we talk about when we think about adulting. However, the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that's deep in your brain here, kind of like in between your ears deep, it's an almond-shaped structure, and it's all about survival and self-preservation. When you are feeling stressed, you have, not everyone, but many of us, including me and including you, we go to the path of emotional eating. And we crave high fat, high sugar foods because it's calories. So donut or tortilla chips or, you know, cheesy noodles for you, whatever it may be. It's that sense of calories equals survival. We are eating simply because that is our brain mechanism. It is not you. It is not your fault. It is the biology of stress. So how do we tackle that? If we start berating ourselves and, you know, if you say, I can't believe I ate that, as many of us do, if you say, you know, I can't believe I ate that donut, or I can't believe I ate that chocolate cake, oh no, not again, then it just creates a little bit of a negative feedback loop and there's all sorts of negative ramifications of that. Instead, let's get at it through the back door. Let's think about what is causing you to have that sense of emotional eating. It's the stress, right? So when you start doing the 20-minute walk, when you protect your sleep and go, you know, try to sleep early, when you do all of the various strategies that are very detailed in the 5 resets, your emotional eating over time can improve because it's not about the actual eating. The eating is just what you're seeing. What's behind that? It's the stress. When we manage the stress, we can then manage the emotional eating. That's not to say that, you know, we shouldn't allow ourselves to indulge from time to time. I mean, of course, you know, Thanksgiving here in the US is around the corner, and it's something that I'm very much looking forward to. And as many of us are, you know, there are moments in life, the holidays are coming up. There's so many moments in life where we are going to be around delicious food. You're traveling through Asia right now. You are having celebratory meals all the time. And of course, it's wonderful to indulge. But this is about emotional eating and stress eating and what happens to us. So in terms of bad habits, like you're asking, you know, how do we get at that? How do we really think about how to manage and overcome our bad habits? It's by getting at our stress. Amazingly, what I have seen over and over is that emotional eating, when people have that sense of stress eating and emotional eating, when you target your stress and really start making strides in managing your underlying stress, and it doesn't take long to do, you know, like a week of really protecting your sleep, focusing on some form of daily movement, minimizing social media use, spending time with loved ones, all of these things that we know have a demonstrated effect on stress can also have a demonstrated effect on emotional and stress eating, because it's all connected. We are one human engaging in lots of different behaviors. So when we make a positive impact on one, there's often a ripple effect. What's good for your body is good for your brain, and vice versa. And it's all about that mind-body connection, which is nothing more than the basic understanding that our brains and our bodies are inextricably linked and in constant communication. And so therefore, what's good for your brain is good for your body, and what's good for your body is good for your brain.
Yeah, there's a key point you mentioned there when you first started this, which is that it's not you, right? When you're having these thoughts, and it's almost good to separate these survival thoughts that are coming from your amygdala.
Yeah,
that is a separate identity almost, right? We have identities. Sometimes we have the angels. Sometimes we have the devils that are telling us to, you know, to drink this or to eat that or to do this and spend money and all these things. And then we have the logical side of our, as you mentioned, the prefrontal cortex. And it's often good to have these different identities, right? I think therapists sometimes do this, where if you have a part of you that's not as happy, let's say, or that's not as excited, sometimes it's good to name that person and have that as like a separate identity, and realize that it's you is a very complicated subject, and all of the thoughts that we have in our daily lives does not make up who we are and what we actually are. And I think that's a separator, just because I agree that stress can mitigate all of these things. That's probably the root cause. But oftentimes stress is thrown at us, right? I mean, if you are in a business and something can go wrong, it's totally out of your control. You could have slept well. It's just external stresses, and that could lead to these negative things that are happening. So I think that's a really good point you mentioned, is that it's important to separate these thoughts that are coming in and say, okay, that's not actually me talking. It's this other part of me that I should sometimes not listen to.
Yeah, you have to name it to tame it. So it's not me, it's my stress. And like you said, there are so many external stresses, which is why I often say that we as human beings are resilient. It's the systems that burn us out, you know? Yes, building a business is a great example. So there are stresses that are out of your control. And how do you manage those stresses? It's about creating a sense of structure in your daily life, building up that bandwidth within your daily life. So when you are committing to protecting your sleep, like the vital resource it is, when you consider it as a therapeutic intervention and really, you know, limit your, you know, protect your sleep, aim for 8 hours. Ideally, if you are having fragmented sleep and you're waking up often, try for 9 hours if you can. But when you are focusing on 20 minutes of daily movement and protecting your sleep, when you are limiting consumption of your phone, and we can talk about some very practical strategies of how to do that, especially when you are an entrepreneur and a business person. As you know, I had a clinical practice in Boston, and it was really where a lot of entrepreneurs have lived. And so seeing so many of my entrepreneurial patients and how they're always on day and night, always on for their work. And how do you really manage that? So there are ways that you can bolster your sense of stress reduction in your daily life, so that when that inevitable big hit comes, right, from the external world, which of course it will because you're building a business and it's going to get stressful, you are better able to manage those onslaughts. It's not about, you know, what I like to say is that we are living through the perfect storm, and it's just been one onslaught after the other, whether that means like climate crisis or various conflicts in the world or our own things that are happening in our personal world or professional world. That perfect storm scenario continues over and over, year after year. It's not about managing the storm, because it's the weather. It is something that is just on the outside. What can we do? We can wear a raincoat to keep us warm, safe, and dry to weather these storms. And the resets, I have 5 resets and 15 strategies in the 5 resets. That is a way to weather the storm. Let it serve as your raincoat.
Yeah. There's kind of this idea of perception of stress is also something that I want to discuss. There was a study done in Stanford where they studied the people that went through a very similar stress event. And one group was thought to have viewed the stress as like a helpful part of their life. They saw that as a positive thing, as a way to help them grow. And then the other saw it as more harmful, as they saw it as a negative light. And what they found is that the emotional health well-beings of the people that went through the same stress events, the people that thought of stress of that event as a positive experience, actually did not have the same negative effects as the people in the latter group. And the takeaway, I guess, from that study was that trying to stray away from stress all the time and avoid stress can often lead to, I guess, deeper long-term stress in some sense. What are your thoughts on that and kind of people's relationship with stress and how they can navigate that?
I'm not familiar with that study, but it sounds awfully similar to several of the studies that are in Kelly McGonigal's book, The Upside of Stress, which talks a lot about this in detail, how stress is good for you. You know, a human's perception of stress, a stressful event, and how it is perceived is so, so nuanced and complicated. It is based on so many things, our own constitutional makeup, you know, genetics, upbringing, prior experiences, a history of trauma. So it is very difficult to say that some external thing that happens will have the same impact on you as it will me, as it will the 100 people that we ask. And so it's difficult to really tease that out. And I'm eager to now, after this conversation, to go and read that study to see how they did that and what the stress was and you know, what that big takeaway was. But I think what I would say to that is that if you are experiencing stress and you have that perception of, oh, this is a really difficult thing that's happened to me, honor that perception. Understand that, yes, if you are feeling that sense of like, wow, this is really hard for me, that yes, it is hard for you, that it doesn't have to be discounted, that experience that you're having doesn't have to be discounted because someone else went through the same thing and said, oh, I could handle this, that's easy for me. Because typically when we push away those negative emotions and say, oh, you know, I'm fine, it's okay, that is feeding into that resilience myth and that idea of toxic resilience. It is okay to feel a sense of suffering when you are experiencing something. And I wouldn't necessarily say that, you know, having a stressful experience makes you stronger. I think that's feeding into a lot of those ideas that we are working to debunk. I do think that there are, over time, when you practice the resets and bring them into your life, you will be able to manage stress better simply because of the biology of your stress. You aren't going to be running on fumes. You're not going to be, you know, pouring from an empty cup, because when your cup is full, you're able to fill others' cups, right? So that goes for being a business owner. It goes for so many aspects, being a parent. You are able to function and thrive in the various roles that you are in because of your ability to self-soothe, have a sense of self-compassion for yourself, and ultimately understand that if you are experiencing something negatively, like, for example, this cohort of people who said that they were, that they had a, you know, bad, that the stressful experience, whatever it may be, impacted them negatively, I would lean into your sense of self-compassion if that resonates with you and you say like, oh yeah, this something happened to me and something happened to someone else. The other thing I would say about that, Sean, is that there is, you know, group therapy, the basis and premise of group therapy is to help to normalize and validate difficult experiences. And so when you are facing stress and if you're feeling like, oh, this is really difficult for me, that idea of naming it to taming it, the idea that, you know, to really tame it, we have to name it. So saying like, yeah, this really sucked for me. This was really difficult. I would almost venture to say, and I'm curious to read this study, that feeling that sense of like, yeah, this was a tough thing for me can help you cope with it because it helps to normalize and validate the experience so that you can then decide what steps to take next.
Oh, interesting. So talking about the fact that you're stressed, communicating that to a group of people, you're saying that can actually normalize it and therefore reduce the amount of stress that you're facing because it's not just you holding it all in?
Well, not necessarily. So for group therapy, when the premise of group therapy is this notion that when you experience something very difficult and traumatic and stressful, that you are in a room, let's say with 10, 15, 20 people sharing your experience. Now, when you experience something really difficult, it is often isolating. I call stress the great paradox because it is something we all universally experience, and yet we are isolated in that experience. We don't share with others. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we just shared how, yes, I am stressed. This is what's stressing me out today, Sean. What about you? And then you say, oh, this is what's stressing me out. And so we kind of go around the room metaphorically to talk about what feels stressful in our daily experience. And then it helps to normalize and validate it for ourselves because we hear our story in someone else, which is the basis of group therapy. And the sense of a group effect. So the group effect is a scientific term. What that means is when you are together in a group sharing your ideas, your thoughts, your emotions, there is this like effect that it has on you. It feels very therapeutic. And so what I'm really promoting is talk about your stressors with people that you trust. Let them share their stressors with you, you know, things that are bothering them in their lives. Create that therapeutic environment because that is very healing.
Mm. How would that work in practice? I think it's a great idea. And maybe for people that can't afford a therapist in their local city or online, especially to do it on a weekly basis, could resort to something like this. How would that work in practice? Like, what's the ideal number of people? What's the kind of the agenda? Do you need some sort of a therapist there to guide everyone? Does someone have to host?
Great question. I am not a psychologist. I'm an MD. And so typically I refer many of my patients. When I had a clinical practice, I referred so many patients to psychologists. And then the psychologist would then determine, is this person better suited for one-on-one counseling and with, you know, with either them or others? Is this person better suited for trauma-informed counseling? That is another niche within therapy, because if someone has a history of trauma, trauma-informed therapy is really best. Or is this person better suited for group therapy based on their needs and stories? So if you are struggling with your stress and you are looking for professional support, talk to your doctor, talk to a psychologist, and figure out what you can do. There are many, many ways to help with your stress. And of course, psychological counseling is a big one. It also changes your brain the same way that many of these things that we've talked about, including sleep, exercise, and all of these other aspects.
Yeah, powerful. So if someone is stressed right now, a lot of people are stressed right now. Maybe some of them are going through quite a chronic stress experience. What's like the first step they should take?
The first step, if you are feeling stressed, is understanding that you are not alone and it is not your fault. If you need to tell that to yourself 5-10 times a day, because when you are feeling stressed, that self-preservation part of your brain is on high alert. Your inner critic is on high alert. And these are all, again, the biology of stress, that's why it's happening. So if you are feeling stressed, please understand that you are not alone. Over 70% of people in every sector are feeling some aspect of stress or burnout in their lives. There are many features to stress and burnout. It doesn't look the same for everyone. There are more atypical features of burnout and stress now than ever. And it is not your fault, like we talked about earlier. You are resilient. It is your innate biological ability. But it is the people, individuals like you and Sean, you and I and everyone listening, we are resilient. People are resilient. It's the systems that burn us out. Systems like impossible demands at work, the challenging demands of being a parent, and just the many demands of constantly being an informed citizen at all times. There are so many factors that are external that are really adding to that level of stress within us. So you are not alone, and it is not your fault. And that you can overcome your stress towards true resilience by understanding the biology of stress, and that you have the power to reset your stress through small, very incremental, practical, free, and science-backed strategies.
You have 15 proven strategies or techniques in the book. And I wanted to just go through, one scenario that can happen. And maybe you can suggest, we're not going to have time to go through all 15, obviously. But for someone that has gone through, let's say, chronic stress, like what's one of the powerful techniques in your book that someone can implement today?
So the five resets has five mindset shifts. So I take someone through, ideally the person who's reading the book does have chronic stress. And then this is a way to figure out what your stress is and how to get better. And there are many techniques in the book. One of them, which I talk about a lot, is this idea of stop, breathe, and be. And so you can try this right now today at home if you're listening, if you're feeling a lot of stress. It is a technique that is quite literally in the name. So it strengthens your mind-body connection. And it was one of the first techniques that I personally started using when I was a stressed patient, when I was working 80 hours a week as a doctor. And what I would do is you try to choose a mundane repetitive task. So maybe it is logging onto your computer. Maybe it is right before you hit join meeting and join your Zoom call. For me at the time, it was knocking on the patient's door in the exam room and turning the doorknob. I did that 30, 40 times a day. It was a very stressful experience being a medical resident, seeing, death and dying on a daily basis. And with very little sleep and all of the other things that I talk about in great gory detail in the five resets and my personal story. One of the most important strategies I learned and the earliest ways to tap into my mind-body connection and feel a sense of grounding was the stop, breathe, me method. So what you do is right before that mundane repetitive task that you're going to do all day, every day, you stop. You take a deep breath. That's the breathe part. You take a deep breath and you ground yourself, and then you be. And it's a 3-second exercise. And initially you can say that to yourself. I used to say it to myself, whisper it to myself before I entered the patient room. Stop, breathe, be. And I did that over and over again all throughout my day. And the stop, breathe, be method helped me feel a sense of grounding, get present in the moment, in the here and now, stopped my anxiety and anticipatory thinking, which is the what if, it's a future-focused emotion anxiety. It's thinking about what if rather than what is. So it curtailed that train of thought. And it got me more comfortable in my body, in my breath. And over time, that strengthened my mind-body connection. It didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen in a week. But after 2-3 weeks of consistently practicing stop, breathe, be, I was able to get a better handle on my stress. It is not the only thing I did. I did many other strategies that I talk about in the book. Every single strategy that I have outlined in detail in the book is something I have tried for myself. I've done this with patients. There is a lot of science behind all of the things that I recommend. And this particular one, it helps you move away from the fight or flight response that we've talked about in depth today. And it gets you into the rest and digest part of the brain and the body. So it moves away from the sympathetic nervous system to the parasympathetic nervous system. Very fancy words, simply saying that it moves us away from that amygdala that we've talked about and the fight or flight response and the cortisol and all of the things that we know about. And it moves us over to back into that prefrontal cortex area that we talked about, that is about strategy, planning, organization. It makes you feel a sense of calm. It just grounds you so that you are able to manage the tasks ahead.
And 3 seconds, you're saying total.
Three seconds, repeat it as often as you can throughout the day.
Beautiful. Well, I think that's a great actionable takeaway for everyone to take today, right now. Aditi, thanks so much for coming on the show. And we can't wait to have you come back on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was an absolute pleasure.
Awesome.